And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz on Thursday, May 28th. And I would suggest that perhaps you have a pencil or pen and some paper handy, because just might be a web page, an email address, maybe a date, a time, a location, something to jog your memory in case there's something you want to do, because that's what this program is all about. I give you the information and you go out and do stuff. Yeah, that's the way it works. Let's start off with announcements. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team, is having a restoration this Saturday, May 30th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. They're going to be at Baldwin Creek, which is on Wilder Ranch State Park. What a wonderful way to spend a spring day, pulling weedy species along the coastal bluffs and taking in those beautiful views. Come on out and join us for this neat adventure. You will not be disappointed. We will meet up at Wilder Ranch and carpool to our destinations. Here's the directions. Take Highway 1 north through Santa Cruz. It's actually west. And then continue west to the turnoff on the left-hand side of the road for Wilder Ranch. That's a few miles out of the town. Watch for the sign indicating a left turn. Once at the kiosk, let the person know you are volunteering and they will give you a parking pass. Meet us at the interpretive sign by the bathrooms in the parking lot. So go to Wilder Ranch, get a parking pass at the kiosk, and park by the interpretive sign near the bathrooms. And once again, that's this Saturday, May 30th at 10 a.m. at Wilder Ranch State Park. They'll be going up to Baldwin Creek. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome volunteers from 8 to 80. Please wear comfortable layered clothing. And you might want to have that on the light side. A little foggy in the morning might brighten up. Do bring something to drink, and they like lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine and fog. But if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Please bring your gloves and your water. For more information, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number is 831-462-4041. That's area code 831-462-4041. You could email her at redwoodrn, that's REDWDRN, at pacbell.net, or visit their webpage at www.cruisecnps.org. Rebel, Rebuild, and Rewild 2015 from Rebel, Rebuild, Rewild. As found in the Earth First Newswire, dear comrades, rabble-rousers, nature-loving radicals, and aspiring revolutionaries, it is with excitement that we announce the second annual Rebel, Rebuild, Rewild Action Camp, which will take place on unceded Algonquin territory this summer. RRR 2015 will run from June 22nd through the 28th in a beautiful forest setting north of Ottawa, Canada. Rebel, Rebuild, Rewild is an eco-anarchist action camp where those of us who dream of a wild future can meet, get to know each other, educate one another, learn skills, and organize for the liberation of Mother Earth. We believe that on behalf of future generations, the oppressed people of today, and all our relations, we are called to take action to defend the water, air, land, and biodiversity upon which our survival depends. We also acknowledge that the environmental movement does not exist in a vacuum. Civilization is not based only on the exploitation of nature, but also on the oppression of innumerable human beings. More than by the police, we are subjugated by a complex hierarchy devised by our rulers over the centuries to keep us divided. Earth liberation means human liberation, and human liberation means dismantling oppression in all its expression. Therefore, values of anti-racism, anti-sexism, decolonization, and queer positivity will be woven into our organizing. We also believe that fighting against specific industrial projects can only advance our cause so far. To truly enact revolutionary ambitions, we must be building the world we want to replace the current social order with. For this reason, RRR will include space for workshops on earth skills such as do-it-yourself healthcare, gardening, permaculture, foraging, crafting, squatting, scavenging, wilderness survival, etc., etc., etc. We are counting on you to make this camp happen. We are now accepting proposals for workshops, skill shares, discussions, trainings, and reactivities. Write us at rebelrebuildrewild@riseup.net. That's rebelrebuildrewild@riseup.net. And tell us what you can offer and what you want the RRR to include, or ask us questions. More details will be forthcoming, so stay tuned to Earth First Radio for more details. Once again, the date, June 22nd through the 28th, north of Ottawa, Canada. And the California non-lead ammunition requirement is approaching in this story from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Starting July 1st, 2015, non-lead ammunition will be required when hunting on all of California Department of Fish and Wildlife lands and for all Nelson bighorn sheep hunts anywhere in the state. California Department of Fish and Wildlife reminds hunters who plan to hunt bighorn sheep or at any of the CDFW's wildlife areas or ecological reserves where hunting is allowed only on or after July 1st to acquire non-lead ammunition well ahead of their hunt. Hunters are also encouraged to practice shooting non-lead ammunition to make sure their firearms are sighted in properly and shoot accurately and reliably with non-lead ammunition. Please note non-lead ammunition for some firearm calibers may be in short supply, and hunters should plan accordingly. CDFW held 14 public meetings in 12 cities from Eureka to San Diego to gain comments from hunters on how to best implement AB 711, the legislation that requires non-lead ammunition for all hunting statewide by July 1st, 2019. Department listened to feedback from hunters and proposed to implement plans that would be the least disruptive to the hunting community while adhering to the requirements of the law. The California Fish and Game Commission recently adopted the implementation plan. Further phase-out of lead ammunition for hunting in California will occur on July 1st, 2016, a year from now, when hunters must use non-lead ammunition when hunting with shotguns for upland game birds, except for dove, quail, and snipe, small game animals, fur-bearing mammals, and non-game birds, except when hunting at licensed game bird clubs. Non-lead ammunition will also be required when taking wildlife for depredation purposes anywhere in the state. Starting on July 1st, 2019, hunters must use non-lead ammunition when taking any animal anywhere in the state for any purpose. Lead ammunition may still be used for all non-hunting purposes, including target shooting. The implementation of AB 711 does not affect laws regarding the existing non-lead condor zone, where it remains illegal to hunt using lead ammunition of any kind. Hunting is not allowed at all CDFW wildlife areas and ecological preserves. For those areas where hunting is allowed, non-lead ammunition will be required starting July 1st, 2015. Hunters are reminded to be familiar with all hunting regulations before going into the field. If you need more information, please go to the website www.wildlife.ca.gov. And we just had the 25th anniversary of the Redwood Summer Bombing. May 24th, 2015 marked the 25th anniversary of the 1990 bombing of logging reform activist Judy Berry and her partner Daryl Cherney. The bombing remains an unsolved crime. Here is a brief recap of the historical and political context of the bombing and attempted framing of Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney by the FBI and Oakland Police. In the spring of 1990, the Forest Forever Initiative, officially Proposition 130, had just qualified for the November 1990 ballot. If passed, it would have outlawed clear-cutting, required actual sustained yield logging, put real teeth in the forest practice rules and their enforcement, and end industry domination of the State Board of Forestry. It would also place a moratorium on logging the remaining old-growth redwood forest. Had it passed, it would have totally blocked the liquidation logging plans of Georgia Pacific, Louisiana Pacific, and especially Pacific Lumber, which had only 4 years earlier been taken over by corporate raider Charles Hurwitz and his Maxam Corporation of Houston, Texas. Early polling showed the initiative was supported by a strong majority of Californians. Passage of Prop 130 would have caused losses in the billions of dollars to Pacific Lumber alone and hundreds of millions of dollars in losses to Georgia Pacific and Louisiana Pacific. The three corporations launched an all-out multi-million dollar effort to defeat the initiative. Redwood Summer was a summer-long campaign of nonviolent protests and demonstrations intended to prevent the three biggest redwood logging corporations from preemptive clear-cutting of the forests in Mendocino and Humboldt counties before the passage of Prop 130. Judy Berry said so to local radio and TV interviewer Ed Cowas early in 1990 before the planned protest campaign was even named Redwood Summer. Shortly after, a news story by Mike Janiala of the Santa Rosa Press-Democrat quoted Judy Berry calling for a nationwide turnout of protesters for a summer-long campaign of nonviolent demonstrations similar to the protests in 1964 against voting rights in the South. That story was carried by Associated Press and appeared in newspapers nationwide, resulting in a huge response from people wanting to join in. It also made Judy Berry the best-known logging opponent and organizer, and therefore made her a target of corporations that would be impacted by forest practices reform. It was in this context that a pipe bomb was placed under Judy Berry's car seat and exploded, maiming and very nearly killing her and injuring Darrell Cherney as they traveled through Oakland on an organizing trip to Santa Cruz, California, for Redwood Summer. Oakland police, at the behest of the FBI, arrested Berry within hours of the explosion, announcing to the media that she and her passenger, fellow organizer Darrell Cherney, were terrorists who had blown themselves up with their own bomb on their way to do a terror bombing. The false arrest and the bogus terrorist accusations discredited Judy Berry and the Earth First Movement and chilled plans for their nonviolent Redwood Summer campaign. All this was used by corporate PR agents to create public distrust of all the environmentalist groups who worked to support Prop 130 and ultimately to cause the initiative's electoral defeat by just a few percentage points when November 1990 rolled around. Now, 25 years after the bombing, the crime remains unsolved. Judy Berry died in 1997 of cancer, but she was exonerated of the false accusations by police and the FBI that she was blown up by her own bomb. In 2002, a federal jury in Oakland delivered a $4.4 million civil judgment against the Oakland police and FBI agents who had falsely accused and arrested her and Darrell Cherney. Fully 80% of the damages were for violation of their First Amendment rights to speak out and organize politically in defense of the forest. The jury agreed that the cops deliberately, not mistakenly, used false arrest and false and defamatory terrorist accusations in order to shut down their organizing of Redwood Summer. One of the first rules of crime investigation is to follow the money. That is, to look to who might have had a financial motive to commit a crime. As sketched out above, if Proposition 130 had passed, three logging corporations would have been blocked from making somewhere between $2 and $3 billion over the next 20 to 30 years. That's billions with a capital B. Their campaign to defeat it leaned heavily on the Berry bombing and especially the false terrorist charges that had filled the headlines for weeks after the bombing, kept alive by police dribbling out claims of more and more evidence that Berry was the culprit rather than the victim of attempted murder. One of their campaign leaflets called for industry supporters to defeat the Earth First initiative, saying it's too extreme. History has proved the environmental critics correct. The defeat of Proposition 130 allowed all three of two lumber companies to continue clear-cutting Northern California's unique redwood forest for another two decades until they were so logged over and depleted that GP and LP closed their sawmills and sold off the battered forest lands. Pacific Lumber was driven into bankruptcy by Charles Hurwitz, who lined his own pockets with hundreds of millions of dollars in the process. While the Georgia-Pacific Fort Bragg mill closed in 2002, the Mendocino Coast was left without a single remaining sawmill for the first time since the 1850s, when white men first came there to log the redwoods. The Judy and Darrell bombing crime remains unsolved 25 years later because it was never honestly investigated by authorities who were in fact engaged in a campaign of disinformation intended to pin the crime on the victim. They called it COINTELPRO. Evidence produced during the 2002 civil rights case and trial against the Oakland and federal defendants showed that they only investigated environmental activists as potential suspects and did nothing whatever to investigate the corporations and their agents despite a clear multi-billion dollar motive to target the best known and most effective opponents as part of a plan to derail Redwood Summer and ultimately defeat Prop 130. The crime remains unsolved because what police agency can you turn to when the FBI itself was involved in it? Daryl Cherney has continued to pursue evidence in the case and continues to offer a $50,000 reward. He has asked the Mendocino County Sheriff to investigate. The Sheriff's Office reportedly said it will look into the evidence that the crime originated in Mendocino County, which would give it jurisdiction. With director Mary Liz Thompson, Cherney also produced a new documentary film about the case. It has been showing at film festivals and in limited theatrical showings around the country over the past year. The film is titled Who Bombed Judy Berry? It is based on Judy Berry's own telling of the story while under oath just a month before her death. As Judy speaks, the picture shifts to show the events and happenings she describes using activist documentary video footage. The film is available on DVD. If you're interested, go to www.whobombedjudyberry.com. That's whobombedjudyberry.com. Judy is spelled J-U-D-I, her last name B-A-R-I. For more information about the case, please refer to in-depth reporting on the case by the Albion Monitor, one of the first online newspapers, at www.albionmonitor.com/Berry. Although the Monitor ceased publishing in 2009, a full archive of its 14 years of content is still alive online. You could also go to www.judyberry.org for an archive of legal documents, news coverage of the case, and many of Judy Berry's own writings. That's www.judybarry.org. And Sea Shepherd seeks a U.S. injunction against Japanese whaling. The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, a U.S.-based 501c3 nonprofit marine conservation organization, has filed claims against Japan's Institute for Cetacean Research in U.S. District Court in the Western District of Washington, seeking a declaration that ICR's whaling in the Southern Ocean near Antarctica is illegal under international law. Sea Shepherd is also asking the court to grant an injunction preventing ICR from continuing its illegal whaling and to ban it from continuing to use violent and dangerous actions to protect its illegal activities from volunteer activists defending the whales. These requests are part of a counterclaim that Sea Shepherd, joined by its founder Paul Watson, filed in response to a lawsuit brought by the ICR seeking a permanent injunction to prevent Sea Shepherd from interfering with ICR's illegal whale hunt. ICR's lawsuit resulted in a temporary injunction by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that required Sea Shepherd and Watson to stay at least 500 yards away from the ICR's whaling fleet while it is killing whales in the Southern Ocean surrounding Antarctica. That case is set for trial in the fall of 2016. Sea Shepherd intends to defend the whales in court just as it has done at sea, said Sea Shepherd attorney Claire Lobes Davis, a partner in the Seattle-based Lane Powell PC. Although Sea Shepherd maintains that the U.S. courts do not have the jurisdiction to intervene in disputes occurring on the high seas on the other side of the globe, once the courts are involved, they must take into account that ICR is engaged in activity that is illegal under international law and is using violent and aggressive measures to protect that illegal activity. The request for an injunction against Japanese whaling coincides with the meeting of the International Whaling Commission Scientific Committee currently taking place in San Diego, which will consider whether Japan's latest proposal to continue to kill whales in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary complies with the IWC's global moratorium on commercial whaling and its ban on whaling in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. Since 1987, Japan has authorized ICR to kill whales by issuing it permits for the slaughter under the guise of scientific research, although it packages the whale meat and sells it on the commercial market. In recent years, Japan has authorized ICR to kill more than 1,000 minke, humpback, and endangered fin whales annually. However, last year, the International Court of Justice ruled that ICR's research had no legitimate scientific basis and amounted to commercial whaling, which is in violation of the global moratorium. In 2008, the Australian Federal Court enjoined the Japanese whalers from killing whales in the Australian Whale Sanctuary, which makes up part of the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. Japan and ICR have ignored that injunction. In the wake of the ICJ decision, Japan has proposed killing nearly 4,000 whales over the next 12 years in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary as part of a new scientific research plan. That plan was rejected in February by a 10-person expert panel designated by the IWC's Science Committee and will be considered by the full scientific committee currently meeting in San Diego. In its counterclaim, Sea Shepherd asked the court to prohibit future whaling by ICR in the Southern Ocean on the ground that its killing of whales violates international law, including by violating the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, the Whaling Convention, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Flora and Fauna, and the World Charter for Nature. Sea Shepherd's claim recognizes that the whales themselves, each an individual being with a sense of self, advanced cognitive ability, and the capability to experience profound physical and emotional suffering, have a fundamental interest in their own lives and the lives of their families. As the exhibits submitted with the Sea Shepherd's counterclaims illustrate, ICR targets families of whales swimming as pods, including mothers and their calves, and kills them using grenade-tipped harpoons and automatic weapons, causing an agonizing death that may take as long as 45 minutes. Countries around the world recognize the importance of preserving whale populations that were decimated by commercial whaling before the global moratorium took effect, said Davis. Yet ICR has continued to kill these whales in violation of international law. Targeted species have included the endangered fin whale, one of the largest species on Earth, more than 95% of which were wiped out by commercial whaling. Not only that, the ICR kills these whales by using brutal and inhumane methods and does so in the internationally recognized Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary, where there is supposed to be safe haven. Sea Shepherd also claims that ICR is guilty of piracy for illegally killing and taking whales from the sea for commercial profit and for engaging in violent actions against Sea Shepherd volunteers, including ramming their vessels, hurling stun grenades and grappling hooks, employing bamboo poles as spears, and firing water cannons at vessels and helicopters. In addition to injunctive relief, Sea Shepherd is requesting damages done to its vessels in past years, including for the deliberate ramming and destruction of the Sea Shepherd vessel 80 Gill in 2009. Additional counterclaims by Sea Shepherd and Watson assert that ICR has violated Sea Shepherd's right to freedom of safe navigation on the high seas by attacking and causing significant damage to Sea Shepherd vessels and endangering the safety of Sea Shepherd's crews, and that ICR has violated the International Convention for the Suppression of Financing of Terrorism by collecting millions of dollars to fund these acts of violence. In 2011, the Japanese government admitted that almost $30 million donated by concerned individuals worldwide to be designated for the tsunami and earthquake victims had been diverted to the whaling industry. Here's some background. The ICR and the Japanese Whaling Corporation, from which it charters its boat and crew, Kyoto Senpaku, first filed suit in federal district court in Seattle against Sea Shepherd and Watson. In March of 2012, the district court denied ICR's motion for a preliminary injunction in a carefully reasoned 44-page opinion, which was then reversed by the Ninth Circuit Court. In December of 2012, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals entered its own temporary injunction prohibiting Sea Shepherd, Watson, and any party acting in concert with them from approaching ICR's vessels closer than 500 yards in the Southern Ocean, endangering the safe navigation of those vessels or attacking them. Although Sea Shepherd subsequently withdrew from the Southern Ocean Whale Protection Campaigns, in December 2014, the Ninth Circuit found Sea Shepherd and Watson in contempt of the injunction based on the actions of independent foreign groups that continued these campaigns. That would be Sea Shepherd Australia. Sea Shepherd filed a petition last month asking the U.S. Supreme Court to review that decision, claiming that the Ninth Circuit exceeded its jurisdiction by interfering in a conflict involving foreign parties on the other side of the globe, and that it had erroneously found Sea Shepherd in contempt, even though Sea Shepherd Conservation Society had complied with the injunction. On May 1, 2015, ICR and Kyoto Senpaku filed an amended complaint in the district court renewing their request for a permanent injunction against Sea Shepherd and Watson and also seeking coercive contempt sanctions. Sea Shepherd and Watson filed their answer and counterclaims in an amended complaint on May 15th. If you'd like more information, go to www.seashepherd.org. ATV riders in Recapture Canyon protest ride found guilty. A federal district court jury in Salt Lake City found San Juan County Commissioners Phil Lyman and another defendant guilty of conspiracy and driving motorized vehicles during a protest on closed BLM lands in Recapture Canyon near Blanding. Two other defendants were found not guilty, even though photos clearly showed them on vehicles in the closed part of the canyon. The Bureau of Land Management closed the canyon to motorized use in 2007 to protect thousand-year-old-plus archaeological sites created by ancestral Pueblans. Mr. Lyman and his co-defendants argued that they had received permission to ride on the road from the San Juan County Water Conservation Watermaster, who actually opened the gate for them. The agency has right-of-way to maintain a pipeline in Recapture Canyon. That defense was rejected by the jury. Sentencing is scheduled for July 15th, and the pair could serve up to a year in prison, be fined $100,000, and be forced to pay additional reimbursement to the BLM for damage caused during the ride. Now let's take a minute here for some biological diversity news. Lawyers square off to save Okinawa dugongs from military airstrip. Lawyers are in federal court in San Francisco in a historic case to stop construction of a U.S. military airstrip in Okinawa, Japan, that would pave over some of the last remaining habitat of endangered Okinawa dugongs, gentle marine mammals related to manatees. The case filed by Earth Justice on behalf of the Center and other Center for Biological Diversity and other American-Japanese conservation groups is the latest in a long-running controversy over the expansion of U.S. Marine Base at Hanako Bay. There are an estimated 50 Okinawa dugongs left in the world. Today, that was in 1997. Today, there are probably just a few dozen. The Center for Biological Diversity has been fighting for more than a decade to save the endangered and vanishing dugongs. These gentle animals were adored by both locals and tourists. Paving over some of the last places they survive will not only likely be a death sentence for them, but it will be a deep cultural loss for the Okinawan people, said the center's Peter Galvin. And if you need more information, go to www.biologicaldiversity.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. If you want to listen to a rebroadcast, tune in tomorrow afternoon. That's Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you're in Moscow, Idaho, tune in Monday nights at 9:30 to 90.3 KRFP Radio Free Moscow. And you can always go to radioforall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous Earth First updates. That's radio4all.net. Or maybe sometimes you could tune into northbysouthradio.com. That's northbysouthradio.com, formerly Radio Free Edmonton. And they're sometimes up on the web, and they're sometimes rebroadcasting the Earth First updates. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.